Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association's Energy Markets and Finance Committee. This is the Hot Air Show, your source for editorial and opinions on everything clean energy and climate. Today, we have a great panel. Let's go around the table and everyone introduce themselves.
Tyson Slocum, Energy Program Director with Public Citizen.
Kevin Book with Clearview Energy Partners.
Jean Chemnick with E&E News.
And Bill Snape here at the law school and also with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Well, it's been some time since the last Hot Air Show, so it's really difficult to know where to start. There's quite a lot of material to work with today. So why don't we start with the Paris Climate Agreement? Bill, I'm sure you have a view on this one.
I think I remember what the Paris Agreement is and was. The Paris Agreement maybe is a good place to start because, on the one hand, the president did seem to, on some level, maintain a campaign pledge to get out of an agreement he thought was bad for America, bad for the United States, and he did just that. On the other hand, once he actually was forced to talk about that and to defend that decision, it became, to me at least, more interesting. Whether the general public really got it or not, unclear, but clearly, you know, they just, anything that has the word climate in it, they don't want to have anything to do with, even though Paris, of course, was the ultimate international hand-holding gesture and really did nothing to change much of what the United States was already going to do. It did become a symbol, and I guess if I had to pull out sort of one public policy or sort of American feeling about it, my straw poll of friends and colleagues, and trying to go outside my general comfort level, circle of friends, was that many people were disturbed by the fact that now only Syria, Nicaragua, and the United States are not members to this agreement.
And North Korea.
That resonated with people, that like, why are we doing this? Why are we in that crowd? And of course, Nicaragua wanted Paris stronger. So, to me, Paris is just that. It is a way to talk about climate. It really didn't have anything that was going to happen on the day-to-day level in the United States. And of course, what's really happening, and I'm looking to my three colleagues, here's a softball for all three of you, is we have seen the beginning of the dismantling of not only climate law, but I would say maybe even environmental law, at least some of the pillars of it. I mean, they are beginning the process of at least chopping down all the things Obama did, and whether they've got the smarts to actually dismantle even more, well, we'll just have, time will only tell on that. But that clearly seems to be at least Scott Pruitt's ambition. He wants to demolish the whole thing, it seems.
Gina, a number of folks have mentioned that it's not, you know, an immediate exit out of the Paris Agreement, that it might take a few years for us to formally kind of back our way out. Now, certainly the funding streams to things like the climate funds and such like that have been cut off. But talk a little bit about what the, you know, kind of exit time frame looks like.
Sure. It will take 4 years from the time Paris took effect for us to be able to get out, which puts it, I think, the day before the next presidential election. It's the 3rd or the 4th of November 2020 is when we can get out.
I believe it's the day after the election.
Is it after?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. There is a big, long process. At this point, the State Department civil servants who are responsible for negotiating Paris, of course, were still part of the UNFCCC, the UN body that oversees climate negotiations. So people will still be sent to these meetings. You know, there's a meeting in Bonn at the end of the year. But they haven't been told whether they're going to be in on the Paris negotiations or not. Of course, the rest of the world, that would be extremely cheeky to go into the rooms where Paris is being negotiated and say, no, I object to that. And it would be very likely that there would be an extremely strong pushback if you know, the Trump team gave civil servants the direction to do that.
So we get general admission to the framework convention,
right.
but not to the VIP Paris rooms.
Exactly. But it may be that the direction is to go into the VIP Paris rooms and try to muck up the works, and if that happens, that will be interesting. Those will be fun stories to do. But you mentioned the Green Climate Fund. Yes, we have cut off money for that, but weirdly, we still have a seat at the table because we still have a board seat, and there's been no news about whether we're going to keep that board seat, and we can't really be removed until this next replenishment cycle starts, which is sometime in the next couple to 3 years, at which point we will not give any more money and we'll lose our seat. But we could hold on to that seat as well and direct what projects get the money. So that's interesting.
So we're talking about a departure that doesn't matter from a deal that doesn't matter?
That appears to be what we're talking about.
Okay. So I think Gene's made an excellent point, which is that the task of going to meetings and interrupting the flow of dialogue could be potentially more destructive to the Paris Agreement than the idea of pulling out of the Paris Agreement might have been. The Paris Agreement was a low point for global federalism, probably not the lowest yet to come. You can start with the failure of the European Constitution, say, 12 years ago. You can look at Copenhagen and its collapse. Our post-war institutions don't do so well without a Cold War. And, you know, here's something to look forward to. Maybe that'll be back one day, too. But until then, what we have is a bunch of international relations apparatus, which has proven insufficient to compel. So now it's a question of who does what and for what reason. And a lot of the discussion that we had immediately after Trump was elected was, this isn't the end of renewables. Markets selling off on the green stocks shouldn't. A lot of this is driven by local action, by economic incentives for individual actors and corporations. That also applies to some degree here. There is, however, a difference, and I would call it the aspirational gap, and it's a really important difference. When we were looking at the Clean Power Plan, and for that matter, the MATS rule, here in the U.S., it looked like generators appeared to be making retirement decisions ahead of economic motivation. So if you looked at the historical relationship between gas prices and coal prices and power generation and also the share of gas that went to the electric power sector, you shouldn't have been burning as much gas in the years that we were burning gas. We were looking like we were getting ahead of ourselves. We were aspirationally retiring infrastructure, greening up our fleet, because we knew what the future held. That appeared to be what was happening in the U.S. So the question is, will the aspirational gap close inside the U.S.? Yes, for the Clean Power Plan. But without without the U.S. actively pushing Paris, if there ever was going to be an aspirational gap, will that now close too? And that's probably a lagging effect. After all, the world has changed a lot. By the time the Vatican takes a stand on something, that's a lagging indicator. So, you know, Laudato Si was a while ago. We've already got a sentiment shift behind us. And yet the pace of investment can be very different from its direction. We may be greening up as a world, but this might be slowing us down.
Well, it's interesting that you frame it as aspirational. Someone had mentioned the other day that the Paris Agreement in some ways is kind of like the social media version of international agreements. Everyone's going to kind of go do their own thing, take nice pictures of it, and then show it off to everybody else. And that it's a certain amount of aspirations on how people are making their own targets and so on. Now, I'd like to think that there's enough strength behind the way baseline establishment and stuff is going to get done to make this happen, but there is a lot of wiggle room in the agreement and how people are going to move forward. If we are not part of that scene, Tyson, of moving forward and kind of showing the world the bells and whistles of what we're doing, is that going to dampen what you're seeing happening on the ground here?
Not necessarily, but it's what Trump is doing is just abdicating U.S. global leadership in a number of different ways, and action on climate is the big thing. I want to go back to Trump's speech that he gave in the Rose Garden announcing the withdrawal. What he really was announcing the withdrawal from was the Kyoto Protocol. And what he called about getting a better deal was the Paris Agreement, right? The Kyoto Protocol was roundly rejected by the United States Senate because it treated countries differently and profoundly unfairly to the United States, right? I mean, John Kerry voted against it because it gave a huge out to China, India, and other developing countries. Paris was the renegotiated good deal, because it obligated absolutely nothing on the United States. It offered no concrete commitments other than a pledge to continue to work in concert with other countries to reach the next important step, which would be some sort of binding agreement. So there's going to be no renegotiation, right? The other countries, Paris was that renegotiation. And when you look at the details of Trump's justification in his speech, the big news was how littered it was at its fundamental core with misinformation, lies, and these lies and misinformation that has become part and parcel of Trump's daily tweets and daily policy pronouncements, that's a much bigger scandal than whatever's going on with coordination with Russia. The fact is that we now have embedded at the highest level of our government an infrastructure of deliberate falsehoods about what policies are doing, what the impacts of those policies are doing, and what the results of Trump's actions are going to have. This is really a profound change in the United States, and it needs to be dealt with much more seriously than the media. I guess, you know, a lot of reporters are just, there's so many, and I'm not casting any aspersions at any journalists here. I'm just saying, in general, that there are just so many scandals and so many problems, it's difficult to bore down and focus on one. But if you just go back and read the transcript or listen to Trump's speech, the entire speech is premised on just nothing but lies and complete misinformation about what the Paris Agreement actually did. Now, in terms of, I agree with what's already been said, that the wheels are in motion in terms of what's going on with markets. As long as natural gas prices stay cheap, right? If natural gas prices start to change, you are going to see some potential problems in energy markets that will impact things. And we also have to remember that the United States, our main mechanism to enter into the Paris Agreement was the EPA Clean Power Plan, which only dealt with greenhouse gas emissions from the electric power sector. And of course, the big statistic from last year was that for the first time since 1978, greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector had exceeded those from the power sector. And so regardless of what the Obama administration had committed, he had done, of course, greenhouse gas emission standards for tailpipe emissions, but you need to have a broader look into how we're going to control greenhouse gas emissions going forward from the transportation sector. That's where it's a little more fuzzy in terms of potential reductions. You know, we're seeing what's going on in the electric power sector in terms of renewables just getting cheaper and cheaper, continued flatlining demand and energy efficiency. I'm not completely sold on, you know, Uber and Google driverless cars getting emissions down at the rate that we need them to. So I think there is going to be some need for some big policy, and that's clearly not going to be coming from the Trump administration.
Before we handle transportation versus power sector, at risk of a broad existential tangent, Gene, would you like to comment on the nature of truth and the value of the editorial board?
Oh, in other words, I am noticing a tone with a variety of journalists of just, I think the penny has dropped that you're going to be rewarded with respect and legitimacy for calling this administration out when they say things that are not factual. And, you know, I think there was a caution in previous administrations about doing that and seeming partisan and you know, playing into the idea of the left-wing media and all that. And I'm thinking that, you know, the pendulum has shifted and people really are, they feel comfortable saying, actually, this isn't true. I mean, you mentioned the Rose Garden speech, which, of course, was straight out of the playbook of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. They didn't even give a nod to the other side of the question of whether or not to stay in Paris, which was sort of notable. I mean, you could have said, hey, we're on balance, we're pulling out, but there were good arguments on each side, and this is what was persuasive to me. That was not the speech that was given. It was, a lot of facts and figures and arguments that are put forward by a group that has been dead set against getting out of Paris for a very long time, and this study by NERA, which is a consulting firm that many have raised concerns about the legitimacy of some of their findings. And after that speech was made, we weren't the only organization that did a fact check on it. We did. And I think it was the highest read story. I think it was read more than just the flat story that I did about the speech, you know, saying some of the arguments were kind of not founded or were, you know, counterfactual. But you know, general news sources like the Washington Post did similar reporting, and I think that you know, there's some comfort that that will be received well and that that won't make a news organization seem partisan.
Kevin, the facts that fall outside someone's personal worldview / narrative these days, that are, you know, especially when that personal worldview / narrative is, you know, constantly reinforced on social media, do they matter anymore?
I mean, if you ask the oceans, they do. But I feel like I should probably, as the representative of the right of center on this side of the table, let me say, first of all, we like our left-wing media, and it's good that they're owning it now. We like liberal media and institutions generally, and very, very conservative taxmen and bankers. That's what centrism in America is like today. But we are also very bought into a lot of popular fictions. And I would call it the mystical mitigationists, who have really ruled the roost for too long. Look, it's a lot easier to diet after the first heart attack. Okay, it's very hard to pretend that human life can look 50 years into the future and make a decision that rates the future anything like the present. You can do the math and talk about a discount rate. You can talk about coefficients adjusting the value of something. You can go into these deep philosophical questions about whether or not the world was actually on track to do anything mitigation-wise. But I would argue that what we're really doing is we're starting the diet and then stopping. You know, we're eating some low-fat natural gas, but then we're binging on ice cream somewhere else. And maybe, just maybe, that there's a service being done, not by misinforming the public or distorting facts. No, that's no service to anyone whatsoever. The objective truths of greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere are objective truths. But in how we configure our response to it, maybe this is the beginning of the end of pretending that mystic mitigation is going to work. And now it's time for pragmatic adaptation, a very low church, get down to the brass knuckles of dealing with it.
Well, I think there's a lot of folks who don't want to close the door on mitigation, you know, at this point, because in many ways, mitigation represents switching the technologies that, you know, as we see their levelized costs reduce, have a lot of, you know, superiority in other aspects.
I'm not saying to give up on mitigation. I'm saying that once adaptation becomes an imperative, mitigation will be easy. Right now, mitigation isn't yet easy.
In other words, until you, the effects are more directly felt, and the need for adaptation to start happening in more popular and trafficked places than remote islands, will start to begin to drive mitigation. And I actually wanted to raise a question for this group. There's a lot of emphasis in the environmental community of late on science-based targets, mm-hmm. and looking to focus on really where do we need to get to from a parts per million standpoint to get to where we need to go. And, you know, to part of Kevin's point here, there's the hope that we don't wait until it becomes obvious, because then it might be too late to affect the change that's needed, but that we'll get to that point. One of the things that I'm scratching my head on, though, is that there seems to be a lot of wishful thinking in the real costs, you know, baked into what it, you know, where the science-based targets are being, you know, looking to be achieved. And the sense that, you know, this is going to get done, you know, sans offset projects, mitigation, you know, crediting, you know, using the flexibility that there's reduction opportunities at a variety of different price points across the economy, but instead we're just going to basically agree that we're going to do what we need to do to put this in place. Are we going to hit a point where there ceases to be a disconnect between where folks really want to move in terms of science-based mitigation targets, and a, you know, I'll call it a a bending and not breaking of the reed, as it were. Getting people to where they need to go by, you know, ramping in carbon pricing, getting people to where they need to go by adopting, you know, high quality, verifiable, you know, offset crediting projects and things like that, and not taking this view that that we're going to just somehow at some point get to a hard agreement where there's going to be highly prescriptive measures put in place and forced technology switching in a lot of places where, you know, we've got a tremendous amount of gains. The electricity sector is probably one of the best examples, but there's a lot of other sectors, home heating and other places, where when you look at what the cost to switch to a less carbon intensive or a, you know, zero carbon, you know, fuel source, a service would be, you're looking at an exponential order what the current solution, service provision looks like under the traditional technology suites and so on. So I guess my question is given what you're saying, Kevin, that we need to wait for it to become a little more evident, and given where you have a lot of folks in the environmental community saying, no, we need to commit to act, and in a way that is very, very stringent, is there any kind of middle point, you know, that'll emerge here that'll let folks move forward? Because, you know, my personal worry in looking at all of this is I'm seeing the debate move into the polls on both sides.
Well, that is a long question. And a
very long question. Well, that's what I like to do.
But I'll give it a shot. And I just want to note that Kevin's answer about the true impact of Trump writ large, you know, when history looks back at what happened in response to this administration, you sounded a little bit like Ken Ward of Greenpeace, in that
Nobody says that.
I know. but there is, I think the optimism.
He's got a crane to climb later this afternoon.
Despite how bad it is right now, and I think it is very bad, that, you know, compared at least to what you think it would have been like had Hillary been elected, I do see whatever you call the progressive community that is advocating on some level for action on climate, I think is incredibly energized and focused in a way that I'm not sure it would have been had Hillary been elected. And frankly, Hillary wouldn't have been doing that many different things than Trump. Obviously, she would have stayed in Paris, but it is not as though Hillary was going to walk away from natural gas. I mean, you know, she loved natural gas. So I think in some ways this has heightened the focus and made our task much more evident, and maybe that will include adaptation for all the reasons you stated. And, you know, I think there is a lot to do. But I want to make, that's my threshold sort of observation, but to answer your question, I think it's possible that at least for the next couple of years, targets don't matter. I mean, people are going to be paying attention to targets, and I'm sure there will be lawsuits. I might even file a few myself. So I'm not saying targets are irrelevant, but in the big picture sense of how the hell are we going to get through to the other side over the next couple of years, to me the answer is renewables. Getting particularly wind and solar, but others when relevant and appropriate, to capitalize on the dropping cost. And it's not always the type of dropping cost that we need or want in every particular situation. It is not one size fits all. But to me, that's the hope. And I am a little pessimistic without any sort of focus or push coming from the federal government that the states can't do it all. But I think that the market of renewables is an optimistic fact. And right. I'm holding on to that with every ounce of
energy
I have.
And the states are moving that way. And they're not doing it directly on the science. You know, they're doing political slogans. There's the Senate bill, 100 by 50. They're calling 100% renewables by 2050. California is doing it. It's being debated in a bunch of other legislatures. Some of them will pass in full, others not this session, but maybe in a couple of legislative sessions. So the states are engaged. And we saw this the last round during electricity deregulation in the late 90s, early 2000s, when a whole bunch of states, in companionship with their electricity deregulation laws, established renewable portfolio standards, or RPSs. And those were the catalyst for today's renewable energy revolution. And so I'm optimistic that there are some big states that are starting to push harder on increasing those RPSs, but it would be much better to have a federal approach and a federal standard.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm of the belief that renewable portfolio standards are that issue, and in particular the tiers that have been established for the nukes, is one of the most interesting emerging federalism you know, state, federal jurisdictional issues that we've seen before. Now, about 2 years ago, we had the Supreme Court decide the Tallinn case, where they basically said that if you want to encourage specific types of resources in a state, that the state, you know, when doing so, cannot create a mechanism, in this case a contract for differences, that has a leg of the contract linked directly to a federally jurisdictional wholesale market, where the state support is directly linked to what the capacity values are, in this case coming out of PJM.
Right. And they can't be tethered to FERC jurisdiction.
That's right. The Supreme Court said that that mechanism was no good. However, it was a fairly narrow ruling. And what the Supreme Court did not say is that states do not have the ability to favor certain types of resources for whatever reasons, or other types of resources for whatever reasons. This has been a hot topic of discussion at FERC technical conferences of late, at a number of different meetings up and down, especially the Mid-Atlantic up in New England. You know, you talk to folks up in New England, and they will tell you we want to move forward on this, except for New Hampshire, who does not want to pay for its neighbor's policies. There are a lot of different approaches, and what's interesting is that the states have seemed to be looking at FERC, which is, you know, going to have a very new slate of, you know, newish slate of commissioners, given you know, the filling of the quorum recently. The states really appear to be looking at FERC to say, what kind of mechanism can you guys adopt in the wholesale markets that will back this? And what I'll note is that I've yet to hear someone step out and say, no, a state cannot, on the basis of its public health and safety, you know, state constitutional jurisdiction, choose to favor a specific type of resource via, you know, renewable portfolio standard, via certain type of restrictions on integrated resource planning, and so on. I've yet to hear someone state that definitively, categorically, states can't do that. Rather, the discussion seems to be swimming around how do the regional power markets that cover a number of states with policies like that fairly address the price signaling that generators need to stay in the game and maintain reliability and so on. And so without descending into the details of how we design and tier out the capacity market in PJM, in New York, and other places like that, can you guys comment, do you foresee carbon pricing being the kind of glue that holds this jurisdictional ball of wax together, or are we going to have a standpoint where, you know, you foresee we continue under the circumstance we are now, where you have basically state policy that, you know, certainly has a practical effect in the way that markets perform, but as long as it doesn't stay tethered directly to those markets, like in the Tallinn case, it's left untouched?
Well, there's no question that FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is quickly going to emerge as the most important federal entity on energy and climate policy for the foreseeable future. And there are huge unknowns because we have a big turnover in the commissioners that are going to be making decisions. And the confirmation hearing in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee for the two Trump-Republican picks really didn't illuminate anything on these pretty critical issues. And so, in essence, electricity policy in the United States, for at least two-thirds of the country that where FERC jurisdictional markets reign, electricity policy is going to be set primarily by private organizations, the regional transmission organizations, which, you know, we at Public Citizen have been screaming for years that there are fundamental governance problems in these private organizations that are really bad for the public interest. And we need to have wholesale reform of the way that these institutions function and operate on a daily basis. But I do think we're going to see some form of carbon pricing, maybe not a carbon price instituted by the RTO, but a de facto type through these multiple tiered capacity auctions that ISO New England,
for subsidies, then clearing on systems.
Right, and PJM is going to develop it. But it's all going to be, I mean, all of the major power producers, whether they be, you know, renewable energy, whether they be demand response, whether they be, you know, incumbent fossil fuel and nuclear baseload, they're all going to be pushing for their preferred market approach, which really is, pay us in this market construct. So it's, these markets are as political as anything else, and they're not a fair forum for public interest advocates. And I'm concerned about getting these details right, and there's just a lot of unknowns about who's going to be making the decisions on these issues.
Well, in this case, being for states' rights is, follows with the right to take into account carbon, the right to direct resource planning, and then the nature, whether it's from an environmental aspect or otherwise, of some of the resources that are being constructed and operated within your state's jurisdiction, and so on. Kevin, do you see these commissioners, a new FERC quorum coming in and saying, we're for states' rights, but not when it comes to resource planning?
I think that'll be litigated. I know my colleagues Christian and Tim will be writing about it and keeping everybody engaged. Let me start with one simple thought before I get into that. Load growth solves this, right? So what we're talking about is that efficiency is the enemy of the all of the above world. Efficiency is the enemy of the always-on renewable. It creates new conflicts. Zero energy credits and these massively complex constructions that states, within their rights, yes, an intrinsic contradiction of the Republican Party, they want states' rights, they want free markets, including states' rights to make markets not free. These are challenges of a low-demand scenario. So all you need to do is to go to the Department of Demand and turn it up. That doesn't work. So what we have to accept is that there's effectively economic losers out there. And the question that FERC is going to be forced to mediate is the question whether the economic losers should be the stakeholders at the company level or the stakeholders at the ratepayer level, the stakeholders at the regional industrial level or the stakeholders at the national environmental level. It's a really big job for just a five-person commission, but luckily they've got a very big and talented staff.
I have nothing to add to this except that in some instances, there are some state public utility commissions that are beginning to express a little independence, although they are still sometimes impacted by the markets that Tyson and Kevin were just talking about. And I do think that there will be more advocacy focus on some of these state public utility commissions, Arizona, Nevada, Florida. There are states that these battles that Kevin alluded to are going on, and it is. I agree, FERC is where the action is going to be, just because EPA is completely punted. Interior, wants to drill baby drill, that will create its own set of issues. But that to me will end up in a draw. I don't think Interior will get too far, but they won't do anything positive either. So FERC, to the extent there's really any opportunity at the federal level to at least allow some of these positive developments, I agree that's the agency, the federal agency to watch.
And it really, from what I'm seeing, the states, without giving an inch on their rights to put in place, do resource planning and renewable portfolio standards to direct resources based on environmental performance and things like that, are looking to FERC to say, how can you adjust the market so it does take this into account? I would go so far as to say it's a very difficult legal argument to say that states on their state public health and safety constitutional grounds cannot go above and beyond when it comes to, greenhouse gas regulation and things like that. It's just a difficult one to make. What I think is interesting is that, New York and other places figured that out. And what the take-home from the Tallinn case in many ways was pick a different rationale, and pick a different mechanism. Make your rationale be reliability and existence of capacity and decongestion of capacity prices and basically all the rationales that are that underlie why the regional market's in place, in the first place. Indeed, regional markets, RTOs, ISOs, a lot of times it's easy to forget that they really don't exist to price energy as much as they exist to allocate transmission.
But one thing I think we need to remember is that Trump and his FERC nominees might have their own idea about what preferences to support. Trump is upending just about everything else that he touches, and wholesale power markets could be the next thing. Remember, in April of 2017, Trump's Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, the former Texas governor, issued a memo to his chief of staff basically saying renewables have gotten a real unfair advantage in today's power markets, and they're coming in too cheap, and they are forcing baseload generation, and they named baseload generation as coal, nuclear, and natural gas, and hydro, although I don't know why hydro is in there. They said yes, but it's not being impacted the way that the others are.
That's right.
And they said this unfairly subsidized renewable energy is creating uneconomic baseload generation, and that uneconomic baseload generation is eroding reliability, and the erosion of reliability is a national security crisis. And therefore, my chief of staff needs to produce a report talking about how to address this. And what we're seeing from the RTOs and from some folks within FERC is, you're right, the markets have not been accurately pricing the reliability attributes that baseload has supported. And so what I'm concerned about is that even though we're all seeing the market forces unleash all sorts of affordable renewables into the marketplace, Trump may try to dial that back a bit by saying we need to slow this renaissance down by providing huge guaranteed payments to baseload generation. We're already seeing it for natural gas, right? Calpine and NRG made filings at ERCOT, the Texas market. Now, that isn't FERC jurisdictional, but they submitted this huge report where they said wind is kicking our behinds in the Texas power market and we're no longer economic. Same thing in California, where renewables are pricing in at almost zero, driving natural gas into bankruptcy. So my concern is that Trump is going to put his thumb on the scale in favor of baseload, and that is going to delay the renewable revolution that we need to address climate change.
I see Jean with her hand up. But Jean or Kevin, or I'll agree because I don't know the answer, but my intuitive guess is strongly that the winner, if when everything Tyson just said is true, and it's certainly what happened is accurate, but if it plays out the way you just predicted, and I'm fearful of that as well, it seems like the big winner in that is coal. Because natural gas is already doing what natural gas is going to do, I think, correct me if I'm wrong. Coal is where they could rejigger the system, try to get coal back in the market in some areas. I mean, do we think that is there empirical reasons to think that that's going to happen? Because I certainly think that's what they want to have happen.
It is what they want to have happen. They need demand. Steel, by the way, is a great way to engender demand for coal. It represents a small single-digit number as a percentage of coal demand right now. But that's something they're working on. Economic growth would create demand for baseload coal.
Infrastructure bills, for instance.
So put a lot of people out on the roads working, put a lot of concrete into the economy. Look, you'll need some electricity, and coal baseload can play a role. In terms of doing it this way, though, I don't think that the Department of Energy has the authority. It doesn't. And second, that conceptually the argument would necessarily favor coal if market forces continued to provide a thermal efficiency adjusted advantage for natural gas. Now, having said that, let me also say this about your 100 by 50 world. It's like starting a maze and saying, well, I can't do this, so I'm going to go to the end and I'll work backwards from the end, and then ripping out the middle of the page and saying, all right, I'll figure it out somehow when I get that page done. How are you going to do that? So going from supplement to substitute is a fundamental shift that is so far beyond our current capabilities.
So far?
So far. Oh, we don't have affordable storage. Okay, you can just shrink GDP at 3% a year, and as we're all living in our huts, I think we can get fully renewable by 2020.
How do you interpret – I argue with you, tentatively when you start throwing facts like that around, but what about the Semper VP out of California saying 2 weeks ago, we can do 100% renewable now, feasible today? Was he
across the country?
I think that was what he certainly in the state of California. I'd start with California.
Now, California is a very special place.
But let's start. I mean, at what point?
He said that there were no technical barriers from the utility perspective. Now, it's important.
Notice he didn't say within CAISO. He said within California.
Well, that's why I'm bringing it up. I have a full.
Well, also, and I tweeted about this, that then his bosses at Sempra forced him to walk that back, right? But the fact is that he was speaking a moment of truth, that the utilities keep saying all this intermittent generation is creating all this havoc. Are there challenges? Absolutely. Are they manageable, and can it be managed? Absolutely. And that's what the Sempra executive was saying.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about, I mean, the rationale behind Perry's memo seemed to be, you know, kind of twofold: national security, you know, reliability, and so on. And from a reliability standpoint, you know, they raised, you know, what are some valid concerns? You know, if you have a coal plant that can keep coal piles, you know, solid fuel on storage, it is going to be more resilient than a gas plant that is, you know, subject to disruption in the gas, you know, pipeline system. One could also say the same thing about renewables and others that don't even need the storage site that are, you know, are fueled, you know, ambiently and so on, but have the intermittency issues that we're talking about. Why can't, if the crux of the concern here is that certain types of baseload like coal and like nukes have the ability to keep fuel on site and therefore ride out a potential disruption, if that's the goal, why can't, similar to how we dealt with winterization on the heels of the polar vortex, when PJM put in place an enhanced capacity product that basically said, if you're a power plant that bothers to go out there and make sure that you don't freeze up when it gets too cold, we're going to value you above power plants that are at risk when it dips below, you know, negative 15, that you're not going to be able to operate, or, you know, dips below 15 degrees, you're not going to be able to operate, and so on. Why can't we simply allow the markets, if that is the underlying concern, to address it with a new product?
Because then it is in markets. What we're seeing here is powerful, entrenched industries manipulating a deeply flawed stakeholder process at the RTOs and at FERC, where they're basically saying, gee, we're not making as much money in this market as we told shareholders we were going to make. So all of a sudden, we don't like this market rule. So we're going to change the market rules to make sure that we get paid. You know, I remember when oil was dipping down to like 30, I think, a barrel, the CEO of Halliburton made a speech where he said, you know what, do we prefer it when oil's at 100 bucks? Absolutely. Do we not like it when it's at 30? Yeah, we don't like it. But that just means we got to tighten our belts and get to work. And the weak are going to be weeded out in the market. We need to see that in the power market. And the fact that they keep saying, giving these threats about reliability, we have to be mindful of that. But just because these power companies say that the market rules need to be changed, we shouldn't take their word for it. And the problem is, the way that all these RTOs are structured, they have the say in the way that these rules get written. And it's a huge problem.
You know, this is broader, and it's not just to do with the power market. But I wonder, I mean, we talk about entrenched economic interests driving, you know, policy back towards sort of incumbent industries. At what point does that shift? I mean, pre-Paris decision, you know, there were all these Fortune 500 companies saying, hey, you really need to stay in. And that was one of the surprising things. You had this Republican president ignoring all of these big money people who he was supposed to spring from in order to go the other way towards a fairly small think tank, you know, of ideologues. And post the decision, you know, Elon Musk got off of all of his you know, commissions, and there was all this sort of pushback from a broader economic, broader swath of the economy. I haven't done the story yet, but I'm actually interested in looking at the money on either side of the question, and what I wonder, and I suspect, that it's actually an imbalance in the opposite direction. So I wonder when that starts to influence, you know, Republicans, actually. Aren't you guys supposed to be the party of business? I mean, like, I'm curious.
Yes.
I just wonder at what point, you know, if you're championing interests that are important to coal, and only a few coal companies were very vocal about getting out of Paris. A couple were sort of like, well, we can deal with it, but you need to adjust it, and we want goodies.
on selling met coal.
Right. You know, the Murray, you know, your specific companies, you know, what is their net worth? And economic, you know, what are they bringing to the table versus the Elon Musks on the other side? And where is that balance? Is there ever a moment where it's like, actually, we're pro-business, therefore we're pro sort of a moderate, very moderate climate policy?
Does tribalism answer all of this, Kevin?
Money does. Money cures all. And the great thing is that when big business is green, big business is going to want green stuff, just like they want stuff that they always want. And there's a certain amount of economic validity when the stakeholders are aligned inside of a country or a community with the large corporate interests that are pushing for something.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, it's not always clear we've reached that point. What I think is clear is that the multinationals that asked the United States to stay in Paris mm-hmm. were thinking about two things for sure. They were thinking about the world after Trump, which is to say the pendulum is going to swing back and they're going to be stuck with their investments and they don't want to be caught out. And second, they were thinking about the rest of the world, which is to say they're multinationals that are bigger than Trump, even the Trump organization with its hotels in other countries, because they have to operate in hundreds, not hundreds, dozens of countries, in some cases more than 100. And as a result, they don't want to be associated with policies that put them at disadvantage. And so that was actually a justification for some of the coal companies that wanted to stay in. Now, to what extent does that mean that they're actually bought into the green value chain? It took GE a long time to get green for real because GE was a company that made things that spin, right? And so when you start talking about solar panels, not their business. You know, what turbines did they want to make? Well, they wanted to make the kinds that spun, whether it was propelled by sunlight or whether it was propelled by gas combustion. When you get to the point where most business is green, you will get to the point you're actually talking about. What I think you're talking about is still business being business, which is that they're thinking about the economic diplomacy and the long-term return on capital risk that they have for their shareholders, and that's why they wanted Paris. The numbers don't add up. We're just generating far much more revenue from non-green energy right now.
Yeah, and I just to add, because I think Gene raises a really interesting point that I think the, you know, especially groups like mine, we often look at policies through the lens of money and politics because it is a very accurate predictor. And with Trump, he's not uniformly doing the money and politics approach, because there are times he's thumbing his noses at very powerful corporations with very deep pockets. And I think some of it is he's deciding that multinational corporations that want to utilize multilateral globalist institutions, that he's telling them, you're not going to, you know, we're not going to prioritize these multilateral globalist institutions that multinational corporations want. We're going to look at what we think is going to work in the United States in terms of job creation and in terms of prioritization for some key demographics of voters that we want to continue talking to, even if some of those policies are ultimately going to be counterproductive, as we've seen in a number of cases, like slashing Medicare and so forth. But I think this has all the imprints of Steve Bannon's worldview, which is a very dark, crazy worldview. But we're seeing his impression on Trump's policies, and that it's not necessarily just moving in lockstep with what big corporations want. And in terms of the coal industry, you know, yes, Murray has some operations down in Colombia, but it's not really the kind of multinational, right, that an Exxon is. So that there is a sort of emphasis on those companies with big operations, primarily in the United States, with not a big focus on those corporations with huge operations outside.
Yeah,
it's an inward-facing worldview, which is I think very dangerous.
I have two very quick points, Gene. Great question. Just on building on what Tyson said, I don't disagree with any of that. I agree with almost all of it. But how much of what he just said, though, is based upon Trump's view of the world through his empire? In other words, he is making economic decisions for the country and the world based upon what's good for Donald Trump and what he is used to and how he deals as a businessman.
Yeah.
Things that are in the business that he doesn't deal with, he doesn't have any curiosity about, doesn't seem to understand. So in some ways, this is provincialism of Trump. I wanted to make that point. The other thing I want to, just the point I wanted to make about the you know, what will this impact of thumbing your nose at Paris, I mean, at what point, that's a microcosm of a much larger question. Healthcare, Russia, Flynn, and Kushner, whatever the hell's going on in the Middle East and Qatar, and, you know, last week at the APA budget hearing, Republicans were more pissed off at Pruitt than Democrats were at times in terms of the budget cuts in the EPA budget. So at what point does the whole bottom, you know, how far do we go before the whole bottom just falls out for this guy and for the very few people left in the administration, which, by the way, they still don't have all the positions filled in most of the agencies. And I just want to remind you of a point I made on January 13th, right before, week before inauguration, and I still believe it to be true, despite his ascendancy of power. Myron Ebel, who I know personally, only got a job in the Trump administration or in the Trump transition team because all of the normal Republican energy people had all gone to other candidates. That's all Trump could pick from at that point back 18 months ago. And he's still hanging around. I mean, Myron Ebel is way, way out there, even among the people who are way out there. They all roll their eyes at how nutty he is. And this is the guy, apparently, giving the chief advice to the president on foreign climate policy. I mean, it just, I wonder at what point does the Republican Party say, this is enough, but that's a question, because it seems to me that they've got more endurance.
But that we might have to get Myron and Chris on to debate.
We might have to.
The old CEI team there.
Well, as long as Trump keeps giving them federal judges, maybe another Supreme Court justice, some big landmark pieces of legislation to overturn Obama stuff, Republicans are going to work in lockstep with him as long as he keeps delivering, you know, far-right red meat to members of Congress. And that's he's delivering so far on that stuff.
Can I just offer some conventional facts? First of all, I'm still struck by the fact that a moment ago I heard Tyson Slocum from Public Citizen sound like he was defending multinationals to some degree over the parochial interests that oppose them, although it was admittedly a coincidence. And Bill, you almost sort of sounded like you agreed with him, kind of briefly. And then second, that the idea that specific people who hold specific climate views are highly influential may be overstated. So I think we all agreed at some points that some of what Trump did in his June 1st speech was to thumb his nose at international interactions, to say to the diplomatic community, sorry, there's a new sheriff in town. So is that because he was getting advice from certain people? Or did he put those people in the spotlight because they were saying things that were consistent with what he already believed, and for that matter, what Steve Bannon wanted promulgated through the administration's policies? I would contend it's probably more the second than the first. I'm not so sure we want to conclude that the EPA administrator is running the show, for example. The EPA administrator still doesn't have a deputy. Now, neither does the Secretary of State, but how can you tell who's powerful in an administration? Usually those people are given deputies. By that standard, at least right now, Secretary Perry's ahead. Is he the influential one? So I think it may be more that these people happen to be saying what the president believes, and that made them useful to the president. It doesn't mean that they were influencing the president.
Let the records show that Phil Snape's nodding his head that's a fair point. Yeah.
And so, that Myron Ebel doesn't have a job at the administration and hasn't since the transition team. Mm-hmm. That's a point. I don't know what that means. But
so let's go back to the Paris Agreement for a second here in the discussion of multinationals. Prior to Paris, we had, nationally appropriate mitigation, measures. We, Paris itself, as we've talked about, is non-binding. It's kind of like, show me the cool stuff you're doing. Approach, mm-hmm. and then we'll get together and talk about what cool stuff worked for who, and then we'll commit to hard stuff at some point in time. Is basically where Paris came out. Now, with that being what Paris is, at least for the time being, it does not seem like there is a tremendous amount of justification where another country could come after the United States on a trade basis on saying that you're not participating. In other words, is this an instance of just lost opportunities in terms of leadership aspirations and stuff like that on the clean energy front for the United States? Or do you foresee actual, punitive trade measures coming, even though Paris mm-hmm. is still a little fluffy when it comes to, you know, binding requirements.
Well, you know that Europe is some within the European Union are already discussing.
Well, they're already
right?
discussing. I mean, like, well, this has always been discussed.
Well,
not just discussed, but done. They did it already, right? They externalized their airplane emissions.
Well, yes, and that's something that we haven't talked about, that that global industry decided that they wanted to take an industry-wide approach.
Well, so what they did is what all the California types are doing with the RPSs. They said, we'll do a much higher standard, but much, much later. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Look, to be very clear about this.
If you're going to fly into Europe, you're going to play.
This trade thing is truly the most interesting part for our firm right now, is we're looking at what's going on in the energy trade war, and particularly the context of steel, green energy, biodiesel. There's a lot of things that are going on right now that have potential to interrupt energy flows. Trade negotiations have and now onto that you superimpose the prospect of accelerated reprisals from our trade partners. Well, would they do it? Would Europe do that to us? Perish the thought. Look, the extraterritorial income tax, they smacked us, right? They went after us. They won in the WTO. What do you do when you win in the WTO? Call the WTO police. No one answers. So you take matters in your own hands. 5% duty on Allen Edmonds shoes, other fine products we sold in Europe, rising 1% per month until October. Finally, we knuckle under. We say, American Jobs Creation Act, we'll subsidize ourselves differently. Which isn't, by the way, a solution, but it works, and that's why lawyers are the winners. But the bottom line in all this is that, of course, they are going to do this. They weren't going to do this within Paris because Paris was about playing nice. Paris was about letting this thing grow its milk teeth and eventually get gnashing fangs that they could use trade as a reprisal. Nobody would dare have said, yes, we're going to chase people away from the table for noncompliance. But now that someone's left the table, what better opportunity? I think this accelerated it for sure.
And then there's also the potential for countries to sort of create relationships around climate change that could also transfer to other things. I mean, there's the EU and China coming together, you know, last month at their summit, and climate change was for the first time one of the major, you know, takeaways of that meeting. You know, when the U.S. and China were interfacing on this, you know, nobody else really could compete with that. That's the primary relationship in the world. But if that's no longer available, you know, and other groups are kind of creating partnerships, why couldn't that transfer into other economic sectors and still be of use to those two partnerships? And, you know, at what point, you know, it'll never replace the importance maybe of the U.S., but, suddenly you're forging partnerships that are around the U.S. that may diminish our relative, you know, strength in some fora that we may not really know today, you know.
Well, so it's one thing for Europe to set up tariffs versus the United States, another thing for China to set up tariffs against their, you know, major buyer.
That would be a glass house. I tend to think that as much as we're persuaded not to go after them on currency manipulation by some small matters of $2 trillion in debt securities, they can be persuaded for their own environmental misdeeds. Particularly when it comes to the holier-than-thou green tendencies they might want to espouse. If you look at the chemical pollution and debasement of their own native water and air in the service of dominating solar fabrication, I think they've got a lot to answer for there. So that would be a tough Article 20B and G of GATT case to win.
Can China go through the 60s, 70s, and 80s that we went through here on toxics, water, and the rest of it, but also, you know, get to 2020 carbon technology. It's a rapid evolution.
Oh, they'll easily get to 2030, you mean? Do you mean 2030?
Well, I'm just talking overall that they have a lot of challenges, but as someone put it the other day, you know, there are, at times, there's advantages to having, a more centrally directed economy.
They're faster. They can do things faster on energy. They have the best energy policy in the world. They will surprise us all. They've already done it. However, there are other consequences of a command economy that I would not want to endure. I'll accept our sloppy energy policy with our blabbering politicians and our scatterbrained, fragmented infrastructure just for the freedom that comes with it.
I'm a big fan of constitutional rights, property rights, voting, and China's got its problems. And government officials have credibility issues. You know, I mean, after a while, when you've got the ascendance of a middle class, you're sick and tired of paying off the local party boss after complaints about polluted water and rising leukemia rates. And after a while, you're like, the local chemical refiner isn't the most important player in town. Its residents are. And at some point, you know, you already see this in the rural countryside where you've got huge demonstrations at times. The question is, will a one-party autocratic government survive the tsunami of a rising middle class and its demands for accountability, for transparency, and for the kind of democratic values that they see when they travel abroad?
Well, it's interesting because China seems to be at an inflection point where traditional environmental, you know, air, water, waste, you know, pollutant issues are dovetailing with the climate issue. You know, the point Kevin was making about adaptation and climate change, there needs to be a certain point where people really feel it, not just, you know, that the weather is getting weird and my grandkids might be screwed, but the weather is getting weird and, you know, my own personal, you know, business or job or property is going to be screwed in the next 10. China is entering a point where environmental issues are a priority to a lot of the populace there, and to a certain degree that might help them close, you know, the kind of realism gap and the presence, you know, gap of it. That is long, I think this is something that I'll ask everyone just to comment on as we wrap up here. I mean, it's been the challenge with climate work. We've all been doing climate work for a long time now. I remember when I got started almost, you know, well north of 20 years now, the challenge, the secret challenge was always, how do you convince people to act to suppress their own consumer convenience mm-hmm. in the near term for, you know, something that is going to happen to their grandkids?
It's the ultimate tragedy of the commons. And my last comment for the day will be that, Gene, that was an excellent question about the China, Europe, you know, the sort of where the geopolitics of the world are these days. And I would just go back to something Tyson said. I think it will be eventually, I don't think China's going to do anything to U.S. I don't think they're going to mess with the U.S. too much on trade, maybe a little bit. It's going to be the fact that China's going to partner with Europe. China's going to partner with Africa. China's just going to keep doing things. And I think we've abdicated our global leadership. We've abdicated it on a diplomatic level, and we're advocating it from really what I view to be the most promising economic sector in the world, which is renewable energy. But I want to end on a more domestic note, which is whether it's the trade cases, and I agree, a lot of things happening even in the solar panel world, which we didn't get a chance to get into today. So I agree trade policy will be important, but I think ultimately, and I know this is a show about hot air and climate, but you know, Trump is so all over these issues these days that I think the rule of law is going to eventually slow these guys down, and they are mostly guys, and eventually really undermine the whole administration. I don't think this administration can deal with the rule of law. And I don't know what's going to happen in the Emoluments Clause case or cases, whether it'll happen with the whole Russia thing, whether it'll happen with healthcare, what will happen with environmental. But I don't know what the trigger or the straw that breaks the camel's back is going to be. But this administration, I think, isn't able to deal with the rule of law, and I think that's going to be its undoing. And it may be climate is a part of that milieu, that the administration's inability, for instance, what are they going to do when they say, well, we don't like the Clean Power Plan, but we still have Massachusetts versus EPA. What are you putting on the table, guys? And their answer at some point, nothing, nothing, nothing. A federal judge is going to say, that's ridiculous. You have to put something on the table. And we're all laughing about it now because it's only been 3, 4, 5 months. But, you know, if Trump does stay for 3 more years, I just see them running into legal problem after legal problem. That doesn't mean that they'll solve anything, and it doesn't mean that we won't have to pick up their detritus, but I do see a really big wall that's going to start stopping them from doing really bad things fairly soon. That's my prediction.
Can sue and settle work in the other direction?
It's always worked in the other direction. It works. That's another topic, too. Anyway, that's my 2 cents.
Oh, I'm supposed to have another 2 cents. I mean, it'll be very interesting. You know, I mainly at this point cover the State Department and cover, you know, international diplomacy, and it will be fascinating to see, you know, what this new pivot to isolation or away from globalization will do to U.S. clout across a variety of different venues. Because of course, Paris is not the only example of that. I mean, there's what happened with NATO and Article 5, and there's, you know, all these different things that Trump has been, you know, doing in just in the first few months. I mean, how does the rest of the world respond? Does it, you know, materially change the U.S. position in the world? And I mean, just I find that story so interesting, and Paris is definitely part of that.
So our domestic deregulatory agenda proceeds apace. It will face litigation just like the regulatory agenda. Some of it probably, Bill, from you. And it will lose in some, if not many, cases. And the only thing that will have changed will have been the passage of time and the accumulation of pollutants. And you might ask, well, so what's the big deal? And, of course, for people who thought that too late was 10 years ago, the big deal is every passing second. But as I think we discussed earlier, and I put all of my oomph into it, so I don't have enough oomph to finish, we are a race of humanity that has short attention spans and very high discount rates. We're not capable of easily committing outside of a command economy like China, outside of the rigors of a binding system of law, to a diet. Our hunger for energy and the freedom to waste it remains very, very strong. And so I would argue that for all that has been said about what Trump has undone or walked away from, not all that much really has changed thus far.
I actually think that consumers are becoming increasingly aware of the impact of their actions and activities on sustainability, on our systems. You're seeing it not universally across the country, but in a lot of cities, and not just in Democratic states, but in Republican states, a desire to eat at a restaurant with regionally or locally sourced farm and meat products. I also teach at University of Maryland in College Park, and granted, I'm talking to college students that hadn't started paying their taxes or paying all their bills yet, but there is a firm understanding by these smart young people that there is a lot more going on in this planet and that they need to understand what their role and impact is on the climate and on sustainability, and that consumer preferences for these things is very important. That's why all these big corporations are responding to it, because they're doing their focus groups, they're doing their polling. You know, it's not just political parties that do that, it's big corporations, and they are seeing overwhelming support for companies and brands to do more on sustainability. And so when I see Trump pivoting completely away from all of that, I mean, this is where you're seeing the state step in and start to do the job to clean up after Trump's mess.
Well, it's interesting because it's easy to come away from this with saying that that same depressing feeling you got after you read Garrett Hardin in, you know, Environmental Studies 101 in college continues way through your professional career. At the same time, I want to leave on a positive note, because I really do agree with Tyson and the fact that we are in the electric and energy sectors. We're really seeing a recognition that the consumer is right, that more consumer choice and optionality is important. And part of what we're seeing right now is this trend towards a rise of distribution level resources, clean energy resources, renewable resources that are sited on buildings, behind the meter, you know, at the distribution level of the power grid and so on, that are that represent not only consumers doing things for themselves, but also becoming producers in the markets, becoming suppliers themselves. And there is an ever more multi-directional dynamic to the way our energy markets are working. And I would argue that, you know, some of the inkling on the global gas market and so on, that there's reflections of this throughout. But in the power sector in particularly, this rise distribution level resources, this recognition that, you know, consumers, if they want to take more of a role in supplying themselves, but also their neighbors, the markets, and so on, that is quite frankly, perfectly viable under the existing market structure. If you look at what the Supreme Court has said in terms of jurisdictional, you know, issues with the EPSA case, there really aren't any questions in terms of wholesale market access for these resources, and so on. And you're seeing trends of markets opening up, barriers to access being removed, and importantly, you know, increased payment and recognition of performance. That if a resource can perform a function, whether it's providing an ancillary service, exporting energy, you know, you name it, that if it can do it better, given where it's located, what its technology is that it's using, and so on, that it should get paid, you know, for how it performs. I would venture that these trends are going to continue because they are fundamentally giving consumers more options, and they're often tied with options for people who are willing to look a little bit further out than, you know, maybe 2 to 5 years on a retail agreement to maybe 5 to 10 years, and seeing overall better economics for what they're doing as well. And so, you know, maybe we are going to get stuck in the tragedy of the commons where we continue not to be able to see the global commons ahead of us, and we continue to act to maximize our own interests as rational actors. Or maybe rational acting is going to be given the technology and the market access where that same tendency continues and, you know, pours gasoline on the growth that we're seeing in terms of distribution level resources, and so on. So it is a hopeful viewpoint, I'll admit that, but it's one that I think has a lot of rationale behind it, and we've ended way too many hot air shows on a down note, so I'm going to end on that. Thank you all for joining us in the heat. We'll look forward to seeing you next time.